Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is Earth Day, so we've invited environmentalist Donella Meadows to look ahead to the future. She's in a good position to do it. 20 years ago, she was the principal author of a groundbreaking environmental study commissioned by the Club of Rome, an international group of businessmen, scholars, and statesmen. The study was called Limits to Growth, and it warned that society was drawing on the Earth's resources faster than those resources could be restored. And if we continued on the same course, we were heading for disaster. This was one of the first studies to use global data and a computer model to predict the Earth's environmental future. Now, 20 years later, Meadows has co-authored a sequel called Beyond the Limits. She teaches in the Environmental Studies program at Dartmouth and writes a syndicated column called The Global Citizen. Meadows told me that her study 20 years ago concluded that if we continued using our resources at the same rate we had been, we'd hit our limits to growth within 100 years.
Right. There are limits ahead, and furthermore, we said if we run into them, we will be very sorry. That it won't just be that we stop, but that we will turn around, that we will collapse, that we will undercut the carrying capacity, the resource base, the parts of the planet that support our own economy and our own population.
So what exactly did you envision for 100 years ahead?
Well, I have to be very careful because we said two things. One was that if we run into those limits, what will happen will be a collapse of our system, by the way, not necessarily the Earth system, but the industrial system. And the second thing we said is we don't have to do that. That there are ways around it to keep ourselves under those limits and yet to meet all the material needs of the growing world population. So we really saw two futures, one out of control and one in the control of human values and human wisdom and human decisions to decide to live within the boundaries of the Earth.
So how are we doing 20 years later? Which direction have we headed in?
Right. That was, to us, coming back to it after 20 years, there were a lot of surprises. One was that the world has chosen so far the path of going right ahead and growing and running into those limits, that the human world in general, its material use of everything from wood products to food to metals to fuels has about doubled in 20 years. So in just 20 years, we've put one whole new human world down on top of the one that was there in 1970. That means we've doubled our environmental impact in just 20 years. And we, of course, have great plans to go on doing that if you look at both population growth trends and economic plans. So that was one thing, that in 20 years, we've doubled the load.
What's the scenario if we do continue at this rate, using forests and water and fuel, you know, what would happen?
If we continue at this rate, yeah. Or even more if we go on trying to grow at the rate we've been growing, the scenario is not one we like, and it's one that we're trying to prevent, actually, by writing the book. There are a lot of ways this scenario could play itself out, and there's a lot of uncertainty around this, because though we know a lot about our planet, some of the things we don't know are how much it really can take. So one possibility is to crash a planetary support system, like we've done with the ozone layer, although we might have prevented that one in time.
What does it mean to crash a planetary support system?
It means so disturb it or erode it that it can no longer provide for us the service it has been providing, whether that's in the case of the ozone layer to shield us from the incoming ultraviolet radiation, which is poisonous not only to us, but to many things, many living things on the planet, or in the case of the climate system, to so disturb that system that it starts producing weather and climate that's very different from the present and very, very inimical to the things that we do, like agriculture or water management. So that's one possibility, but I think a more likely one, and the one we talk much more about in Beyond the Limits, is that the planet will do fine and we won't. That is our industrial society, which is so dependent not only on these resource inputs from the Earth, but on our ability to throw away our waste and pollution back to the Earth. It's dependent on both the source, what we call the sources, and the sinks, the places to which we throw things. That if the sources and the sinks fail us, either or both, what we will discover is it costs us more and more to do things. We have to divert more and more of our energy, attention, money, and capital to cleaning up problems we've created rather than going for our real human goals. And at some point, it just becomes unaffordable to feed people and to protect the soils, or to warm people and move them around with energy, and to find the next source of energy. And it gets to be some disastrous kinds of decisions that have to be made, where we're having to give up things that are truly important to us.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniela Meadows, co-author of the new book, Beyond the Limits, Confronting Global Collapse and Envisioning a Sustainable Future. She's also the co-author of the bestseller, The Limits to Growth, based on a study that was written 20 years ago. To analyze world resources and to create the alternate scenarios that you come up with, you've created a computer model that's mm-hmm. called World 3. Can you give us a civilian breezy version of how this thing works?
How the thing works. It's actually very commonsensical, and you know, if I could sit you down for a half an hour with a computer, you'd understand it. It just keeps track. It's just an accounting device. It keeps track of how many people there are, and the fact that 5-year-olds turn into 6-year-olds and 6-year-olds turn into 7-year-olds, you know, that kind of stuff, and that those people need to eat, and that the food they eat has to come from the land and from energy and from chemicals and from capital like tractors, and that that capital has to be made in a factory, and that that factory has to burn oil, and that that oil has to come from the ground, and so on. It's just knee bone connected to thigh bone kind of nitpicking accounting.
It seems to me, in looking at world resources and food and hunger, that the question gets raised, how much of this is really political and how much of it is environmental? For instance, 1 out of 5 people in the world are undernourished. That's one of the statistics that you use. Now, is that because there isn't enough food, or is that more because of political reasons? And isn't that an essential question to ask if you're trying to figure out limits to growth?
Yes, and there's a lot of argument and politicization around that question. And the honest answer is both. There is at the moment enough food. There is no reason for anybody on this planet to be starving. And we could grow more food, and we could do it sustainably in terms of the Earth's resources. And none of those things are happening. That is, we are getting close to stagnant in our food production. We are undermining resources, and we're distributing it so badly that we have an unconscionable number of people, especially children, starving. And of course, as we grow, and if we continue to undermine our soil resources, at some point it really will be impossible to grow enough food, and even better distribution won't help. But right now, the question of distribution, of sharing, of equity, is, I would say, as important as, and even a step toward, the intermediate term question of how can we fit ourselves within the limits to the Earth. If we're going to be a grossly inequitable society, the chances of fitting ourselves within the limits are even lower. In fact, I would say vanishing. We need equity as a part of the step toward what we call sustainability.
The United Nations Earth Summit will take place in Rio in June, and there will be leaders from countries around the world attending that. Some people are predicting that this is going to be a confrontation between the have and have-not countries. Is that what you're expecting?
Well, it already has been. For the last 2 years of preparation, it has been just that, with the rich countries saying to the poor countries, why don't you stop having all those babies, and why don't you stop cutting down your forests, please? And the poor countries saying back to the rich countries, you're the one who are doing the polluting. You're the ones who are taking those forest products. And so why don't you do something about your levels of consumption? And since it's a you go first kind of discussion, it's not a total disaster. There will be a few agreements that will be reached, but the potential for the 2-year negotiation process has pretty well been bypassed. That is, we haven't gotten out of this at the level of governments what we should have. On the other hand, there's been a global conversation for 2 years, especially in the private voluntary organizations that have been lobbying this process, all the way from environmental groups to population groups to peace groups to development groups. Those people who have not been the official government delegations have been carrying on their own conversation and creating their own network of people who are concerned and who want to see progress. I think it's been an exciting 2 years, and you won't see that on the table in Rio ready to sign in terms of government awareness, but I think the people's awareness and the organizational awareness around the world has come a long way in this process leading up to Rio.
Let me get back to the question of whether the more affluent countries should be helping the developing countries in preserving their resources.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the more affluent countries should be doing that? I mean, for instance, the argument goes, if we want Latin American countries to preserve the rainforest, well, then maybe we should give them some aid to help them do it, because after all, it's exports of resources from the rainforest that they rely on for their economy. So if they're preserving the rainforest, what are they going to do economically unless they get some aid?
Right. We should give them some aid for lots of reasons. That's one of them. Another one is because unless the poor people of the world see a way out of their poverty, they will go on having so many children that the population will continue to grow. And they're not doing that to get us. They're doing that because it's the best coping strategy a poor family has, is to have a lot of children to help support that family in lots of different ways. And if particularly women are not given economic security and education and employment and a stake in the economy, one of the things that's going to happen is population growth will continue. And it will not take very long. This we're fairly sure of from the calculations in Beyond the Limits. It won't take very long, another 20, 30 years, before the population will grow so high that we will not be able, just physically not be able, to meet the needs of all those people. We've got to do something worldwide about population growth, and the best thing that we can do is get into a cooperative partnership with the Third World about their real economic security.
President Bush is the only leader of a major industrial nation that hasn't yet committed to going to the World Environmental Conference in Rio. Do you think it's important for him to go?
No.
You don't?
No, I think it's irrelevant.
Really?
He and his negotiating team have been essentially absent in terms of forward motion in the negotiating leading up to the conference, and I think it would be hypocritical of him to go. I wouldn't be surprised if he does go for political purposes, but all this pressure on him to go, or this question, will he go or will he not go, is the least important question. The important question was, for the last 2 years, did he authorize his team to exert any leadership in the negotiation that would give him the right to go and the pride of signing an agreement that would make a difference? And since he didn't, then I actually would prefer that he not go.
So you think that the United States has been more of a barrier for progress at this conference?
There have been things that, at least I am told by the negotiating team, there have been things that the United States has tried to do and has been a leader on. And, for example, this is not the UNCED process, but aside from it, the ozone agreements, which have helped to reduce the chemical assault on the ozone layer above our heads, the United States has been a consistent leader for 10 years on the international negotiations there. So, you know, I don't think we need to hold ourselves up as totally out of it, totally bad. We have the capability within our government to be a global leader on the environment. However, the greenhouse negotiations, the forestry negotiations, the ability to talk sanely about population and its role in the global environment, on ocean dumping on, what are some of the others? The United States has just not, hasn't been a leader, and in some cases has been a foot dragger, has essentially said, we don't want to talk about that. It's not open for discussion.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Danella Meadows, co-author of the new book, Beyond the Limits, Confronting Global Collapse, Envisioning a Sustainable Future. This is a sequel to the study Limits to Growth of 20 years ago. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
It's 4:21. This is Vermont Public Radio. Programming on VPR is funded in part by Harrington's Jewelers in Newport, New London, and Claremont, New Hampshire, an official Rolex dealer, 1-800-25-ROLEX, and by Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont, a progressive college committed to multicultural education.
It's Earth Day, and we're talking to Danella Meadows about the new book she co-authored, Beyond the Limits. Let me get you to sum up some of your conclusions about where we are now. And what areas do you think we've reached our limits or have kind of gone beyond them?
Well, just make a partial list, but make it very specific. We're burning more oil, gas, and coal than we can burn in order to keep our atmosphere stable and to prevent climate change. We're probably about 60% too high, at least as the scientific estimate is that we've gone 60% too far in burning of fossil fuels, and we've got to cut by that much. We have lost about 11% of our fertile soils in the last 50 years. We can't go on doing that, so we've got to preserve those soils. We've cut about half of our global forest in the last 50 years. We've got to start using the forest at the rate it will regrow and not faster. These are just a few examples. I could go on to fish and water. There's hardly a resource that we're not overusing globally, although specific places in the world are better or worse. And there are very few pollution streams that we are putting out at the rate that the Earth can absorb those pollutants and make them harmless to us.
Are there any areas where you think there's been progress made and we've cut back on our use of resources or using them more wisely?
Yeah, lots of them. The CFCs that threaten the ozone layer, we will stop producing now by probably the year 1995. It's gone to zero by 1995, and that's an incredible change, which was done in a global level. It's one of the best news stories I know. We're recycling materials more efficiently. We're using energy more efficiently. In some cases, we haven't gone as far as we need to go, but we're going in the right direction. We know how to do it right. We know how to produce food at high yield without destroying the soils or spreading chemicals, poisonous chemicals, over the countryside. We know how to run the United States on half as much energy and maybe even a fourth as much energy as we use now. So we can go a long way in this direction.
So what do you think is holding us back from actually doing it?
Part of it is vested interests who want to go on doing things the way we are doing them now. For example, if we cut back on our petroleum consumption by 60%, it's very clear that the oil companies would sell 60% less oil. They would be able to do it for a much longer time, but in the short run, they're not much in favor of that outcome. Part of it is that we're not aware that the signals that tell us that we've gone too far are delayed and distorted and hard to read. And though people who are looking and not denying can see them and read them, it's not an easy message to tell the world, because there are still fish to catch, there are still forests there, even though they're going down. It's hard to say stop.
Do you have a deadline of how many years we have left in the areas that you've mentioned?
We guess, putting everything together in the world model, that if we have not gotten very much more efficient and slowed population growth and overall physical economic growth within 20 to 30 years, that at that point it will be too late to avoid some really bad ecological or economic consequences.
Give me an example of one ecological and one economic consequence you think we'd be facing in 20 to 30 years.
Well, an ecological one probably would be the greenhouse warming, the global climate change, which I don't think people have absorbed how disturbing that would be, not only to the world's environment, but to our own economy. As rivers start having different flows, as sea levels rise, as different species are able to live in different parts of the earth, as ocean currents change, as storm patterns change, I think that would be totally disruptive of our economy. And the cost of staving off the changes would be unbearable. That would stop our economic growth, whether we decided to stop it or not.
Wouldn't those changes be a long time away, though?
No, I don't think so. They will come on more and more and more rapidly because we're creating the problem more and more and more rapidly. And they're already mildly visible, and I think 30 years from now. The interesting thing is not only would they be visible, but at that point there would be another 20 or 30 years' worth of change already in the system, unfolding and unstoppable.
What do you think an enlightened energy policy would be in the United States?
Oh, I think that has been very well thought through by a lot of people, and it would go first for what's called efficiency, using less energy to accomplish the same tasks. That is, we wouldn't notice it in our daily lives. The lights would still be as light, and the motors would still turn, and it would take much less energy to do it. That would be number one, is to go that direction. And then the second would be to slowly make the transition from the fossil fuels, which we can't burn anymore because of the global warming, and which will eventually run out on the source side as well, to the renewable energy sources that we know 100 years from now are going to have to be running our economy. They're present. There are some very ingenious new technologies to use them. These are the energy growth industries of the next century. And though I think it will be entrepreneurs who will bring them about, the government can either be in the way or can help. And at the moment, it's in the way. It's not helping in that direction.
Danella Meadows is the co-author of Beyond the Limits. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
And this is Vermont Public Radio. Programming on VPR is funded in part by Weatherhill Restoration of Charlotte, Vermont, nationally known restoration specialist for 20 years, offering restoration, design, and preservation consulting services, and by the Burlington investment firm of Huttner & Sofer, offering extensive experience in managing securities and experience in leading-edge technologies. Local news is just ahead.